So I went from being basically the son of a coal miner making minimum wage straight out of the Army to eventually rising up through various sales positions in telecommunications, breaking that six-figure barrier at about 26, and ended up as the regional vice president of sales in the Northeast region of a company called Fluke Networks. And they're a division of the company that most people know of is just Fluke. If you see the electricians with the yellow multimeters, that's Fluke. So that just gives you an idea of the size of the company. It's a $500 million company, and I was their top salesperson in the world as the Northeast regional sales VP. And I hated parts of that job, though. I hated sitting down to lunches and dinners with people that I really wouldn't have walked across the street for if I didn't have to, and I hated the travel. 9/11, I was in Pittsburgh. My family was in eastern Pennsylvania. I couldn't get home to them. I'm listening to my wife cry on the phone. My kid's scared. He's asking me if a war can come here, things like that, and I'm not home. So I held on for another couple of years after 9/11, and eventually we decided to come back to Texas. When we came back to Texas, I didn't want to be in this kind of gig anymore, where because the money in sales is in travel. So I switched from sales to marketing, and I had gotten very good at internet marketing. During the tech bubble burst of the early 2000s, I had taken up using internet marketing to get leads for my own salespeople, to put people into seats at seminars and things like that. And I had started selling things like long distance service and things like that. So I'd gotten really good at internet marketing, especially back in those days. If you knew what you were doing, you could drive a hole through the search engines and their algorithms. So I went to work for a search engine marketing firm and ended up as their director of search marketing. And it was okay, but it paid a fraction of what I had made before. I took a step back to go forward, ended up with a company called Sage Telecom as their director of internet marketing, and they were acquired by another company. So I was like, I'm so sick of this. And I had a friend named Neil Franklin, who had said, I want to do something with you. So we founded a marketing firm together called Franklin Spearco. We even at one time had Donald Trump as one of our clients. Kind of ironic that the guy's running for president now, and I wouldn't vote for him if you put a gun to my head. I was pretty proud of that at the time. But in the end, I had just gotten to a point where I was over 300 pounds. I was still dealing, with all the client entertainment stuff. I was miserable. I was unhappy. We got this client that said, I want to do a blog and a podcast and all this other stuff. So I'm like, okay, cool. So I put the bid in for it, and we won the job, and I take it to my lead developer, and I said, hey, Bobby, I want you to build this all out. He says, I can do all this stuff, but I don't know anything about podcasts and RSS feeds and stuff like that. And I'm like, well, I'll figure that out. So I took this $18 Plantronics headset that had tape on it so it would work, and a $30 MP3 player, because I didn't care, right? It was just like, I got to figure out how this works. And I plugged it in. I did episode one of the Survival Podcast. That was in June of 2008. And because of my relationship with Neil, I had a lot of insight to the financial industry that people with a standard consumer-level financial advisor don't. And I think there was a pretty big telegraph punch coming with that recession, but I really knew. Like, a lot of times I say things financially like, I think, I'm pretty sure, my estimation is. In 2008, all I was doing was going, get out of the market, get out of the market, get out, there's a truck coming, get out of the market. And I started that show, and that was like one of my first main themes was financial preparedness. And I went into all different walks of preparedness. We talked a lot about things like doing drills to understand how weak you really were and stuff like that. And in the first 6 months, we're going from June to December of that first year, I got about 2,500 listeners. And at that point, I was like, you know what? I can make this my walk away from the world I hate business. A year later, at 18 months, was when I first monetized the show. And we brought in like $25,000 in the first week that I monetized the show. And my wife was excited. And she's like, you're going to do it. You're going to be able to quit your job like next week. And I'm like, no, no, because that's not going to, we got to build this now. And I built it for another year. And a year and a half, I did. I walked away. Completely walked away, sold out my interest in the other companies to my partners who thought I was just batshit crazy, by the way. Like, how are you going to make a living at podcasting? Well, I'm already doing it, so I think I'll just keep doing that. And the show kind of took off from there, and we went from, 2,500 listeners at the end of that first, half year, and we were like 20, 25,000 the end of that next year. And today we have 150,000 people a day downloading the show. And if you put that in perspective, the the city of Allentown has about, you know, in its whole metro area, has about 100,000 people. So we're 1.5 times the size of Allentown, Pennsylvania, just in an online radio show. And we've gone into just every facet and walk of life in preparedness and self-sufficiency, independence and liberty. I mean, that's what the show's really all about. And though it's called a survival podcast, and we do talk about preparedness, we talk about bug out bags, we talk about, you know, being prepared for anything from a financial collapse to a storm. But it's really more of a variety show. If it has to do with taking control of your own life, taking control of your own money, being prepared to do without systems of support, providing your own food, taking care of your community, we talk about it. And I think it really is the first thing like it that was ever created. And I wish I could say, you know, that I sat down, Josh, and said, I'm going to make this show, that I'm going to start with this survival hook and financial hook, and I'm going to turn it into this giant variety show on liberty and independence, and that was the plan all along. I was flying by the seat of my pants in the beginning, but I had a work ethic that I didn't know how to let go of, being the son of a coal miner. And during those first year and a half, when I still had, you got to understand, I didn't just have a company I owned. I was serving as a chief operational officer for one of Neil's other companies and a chief marketing officer for another company. So I had three companies that I was sitting at C-level positions in at the same time. I didn't exactly have a lot of free time, but I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning when my wife was still asleep. I would go down to my home office and I would set up my show for the day. I would record it in my car. I would get to the office. I'd lock my door so everybody would leave me alone for 10 minutes. I would upload it and I'd walk away from it and I would answer questions when I got home that evening. And that's what it took. But after a year and a half of doing that, I decided, what could I do if I actually dedicated my life to this? And that's how it became the success that it is. Well, when I started the show, part of it was just being genuine in who I am. And the other part of it was, I was a marketer. And I knew the preparedness industry was about to explode. I knew there were a lot of things going on that were concerning people. I knew that the recession I saw coming was going to create opportunity there. It got actually bigger than I expected with stupid shows like Doomsday Preppers and all these other horribly stupid non-reality TV shows. And that helped. So I wanted to be able to be in that niche. But I think it's important that people need to understand that you can have an astute understanding of marketing and an astute understanding of being in the right niche and still be true to who you are. And if you can do the two together, you have a recipe for success. So I chose the angle of what we were going to do based on that. So as much as I was flying by the seat of my pants, there was also this intrinsic, you know, when you do sales and marketing work for 20 years for large companies, you get a little bit good at it. So there was a little bit of a foreknowledge in positioning there. Now, the other thing that I wanted to do is I didn't want to compete with, you know, the preparedness board at Backwoods Home Magazine. Though, you know, I love their magazine. I'm just saying I didn't want to go out and try to capture a piece of a defined market. I actually wanted to create a market. And I thought the best way to do that was to make preparedness something that people would go, well, gee, I'd kind of have to be stupid and irresponsible not to do this. So I came up with what I called modern survivalism, and that word and phrase is everywhere now, and I can't prove that I was the first person to ever use it in any kind of a real thing, but when I decided on it, what I did is I went to Google and I put, you know, quote, modern survivalism, end quote, so you get an exact match search on Google. I came up with zero results at the time. So I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to anchor down on, and then I decided, well, I'm going to define what that is. So then I went totally radical and said to myself, okay, now you should come up with a tagline to go with the survival podcast. It's the worst tagline in the world because it'll be clunky and long and ridiculous, but it'll actually be wonderful because it'll make people go, gee, how would I say no to that? So what I came up with was helping you live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Now, you do have to have a little bit soft point in the skull to say, well, I don't want that. I mean, just think about that, Josh, right? Hey, I'm going to give you a way to live a better life if times get really bad, and even if they don't, you'll still be better off. I'm not interested. Okay, I think you need to have a doctor check you out or something. So that was the strap line. And then I built this 12-point modern survival philosophy off of that. And the first tenet of that guided everything was every single thing that you do to prepare for disasters and emergencies in the future should improve the quality and stability of your life, even if nothing goes wrong. So it was the first tenet was a restatement of the strap line. And I can tell you there were tons of people that came into what we were doing with a little bit of trepidation. And when they heard that, it was over. They were like, okay, this is something I can get behind. And because of that, they were able to share it with other people without being accused of looking for black helicopters flying around in their underpants or hiding a hole in the ground or something like that, because it made a very soft way. So once I had that tenet down, all I did was just look at the average American and go, why do so many people, every time something is a hiccup in life, get their ass completely kicked? And I walked through it. And what it came out to be is, you know, you mentioned Ragnar and stuff like that and how a lot of the things in the wilderness survival don't translate. They actually translate perfectly if you look at them with the right viewpoint. So if I was going to teach a class on basic wilderness survival, I'm going to talk about your five primary survival needs. Food, water, fire is what they'll call it, shelter, and security. And because wilderness survival is a short-term thing, the last one gets left out, health and sanitation. Well, when I looked at the average American, I realized that those six things were always the places they got knocked down. Even when something happened that you didn't think of as being, you know, a cataclysm, something that you would hear about on Doomsday Preppers, if somebody lost a job and they weren't prepared to lose a job, well, you start worrying about the grocery bills and whether or not you can keep a house. Well, there's food and shelter right there. And then, of course, you know, health and sanitation, no one can afford Cobra, right? So if you started going down that list, eventually you realize they were all common. And the one thing that was a little bit different was money doesn't do you any good in the woods, right? Unless you happen along to find some kind of trading post or something like that. Money's useless in the woods. Maybe you could burn it and keep warm for 5 seconds. But in the actual functioning economy, the functioning world that we all live in, money bought all those things. But then I started looking at how people buy those things. We buy them all 100% a la carte. And what I mean by that is we pay our electric bill every month. We pay our food bill every month. And we seldom buy more than we need while it's more affordable. We seldom think about what if I wasn't able to buy it. And these radical ideas, these radical preparedness ideas really weren't that radical. One of the tenets I used to explain this in the formative years was look at all the airlines that were in distress back then. And I would say, you know the one airline still making money? Southwest Airlines. Do you know why? They buy their fuel in mass contracts when fuel prices plummet. So when the fuel prices spiked, and all the other airlines went nuts and then used as an excuse to start charging us for bags and everything, Southwest went, nah, don't care, bought our fuel last year. This is a way of creating a cap on capital expenditures and taking an unknown into a fixed known. And that we could emulate these same things in our lives by buying more food than we needed when it was on at a lower cost, when it was on sale, when we had a coupon. Simple things like that. And then understanding, so now I have a stockpile. Now I have a convenience. So I never have to go over to my neighbors and go, hey, man, can I borrow a cup of sugar? Or something like that, right? We have basically our own little mini store in our preparedness here in our home. So it's a convenience. But it doesn't cost us any more money. Generally speaking, what direction does the cost of food go over time? Generally up. So if I buy more now and use it later, right there, inflation alone, and until we move into a deflationary curve, which I think we're still quite a ways away from, that game works every single time. So these, it wasn't just like this one idea. It was all of these little pieces and parts that were assembled together to build resiliency into our lives in a way that when you explained it to somebody, they'd go, oh, well, of course that makes perfect sense. And you can imagine my chagrin when they had like the, I can't remember what it's called now, but like the coupon reality show come out. And like all the things we were talking about, they're, by the way, those shows are just BS. Like, you can't do it at the level they do it. But the basic tenets of what they're talking about, stacking things, buying more when they're looking for a sale and matching a coupon up to it. And I'll be honest, I can't say that I spend a lot of time clipping coupons. It's not the best use of my time. But when we go into a store and we see something that has a long shelf life that we use anyway, and it's on sale, we buy the hell out of it. And we just put it into our storage in our pantry. And, you know, silver's at like 16 bucks. It was kind of creeping way, way down. We may be looking for a major drop in commodity prices beyond what we've already seen. Somebody emailed me the other day and said, given you were saying to buy silver when it was $25, if it goes to $7, what will you do then? I said, I might be on the roof dancing naked happy because I will be loading up on some silver at $7. And if you just change your whole paradigm about the way you look at things. If you're living like, so what you actually have to do, you have to kind of live like we're in a deflationary economy, even though we're not. So if you are in an inflationary economy, debt makes sense, but you have to stay away from debt because sooner or later debt will burn you. If you're in a deflationary economy, it makes sense to save because if you save versus risk, the strength of the currency is retained. Well, what you figure out is if I start figuring out ways to create more and more inflows of currency, it doesn't make sense to put it at risk. What it makes sense to do is spend the energy instead of figuring out which is my next financial play to actually go out and say, how can I generate more income? What can I do online? What can I do with my existing business? How can I expand the value of what I have? How can I create wealth that the government can't tax? Now, that sounds crazy, right? But I've put in over 400 fruit trees on my property. The value of that 10 years from now is incredible compared to the cost. But how does a government tax an orange tree or tax a pecan tree or tax, you know, an edible dogwood that they don't even understand that such a thing exists? There's no way to do that. There's no way that my property actually gets accurately assessed in the future until the day that I decide to sell it and they actually send a professional in to assess it that way. A county tax assessor can't get their arms around the way I've improved my property. All of these things have accumulated together to be, you know, you're asking me to try to condense the whole philosophy that's been almost 1,800 episodes now down into a few minutes. So hopefully that helped. I know it's kind of long, but that's kind of where we're coming from. Well, I mean, the first place I'm going to start is eliminating the cancer in America of debt. Like, I don't want to talk to you about your investments other than protect your wealth. So we're just going to take your money And unless you really know exactly why you have it leveraged the way that you do, we're going to deleverage it. We're going to put it in completely as safe as we can make it. And then you're going to bust your ass until you have no more debt. And we don't even need to, we don't need to worry about anything else. And if you have to go out and deliver pizzas as a part-time job in the evening for the next couple, it is the number one priority. And before we do that, we're going to stockpile a couple $1,000s in an emergency fund first. And we're going to have that so when the car breaks down or whatever, this is very Dave Ramsey-ish, okay? And that this is where Dave Ramsey and I part ways at the end of this debt snowball type thing. We're going to pay off all the debt, starting on the smallest debt, and we're going to pay that one off, and we're going to roll it to the next one, and we're going to do that. And you're going to watch that cascade happen. And when you decide that nothing else matters right now but that, you'll take debt that you think is going to take you 10 years to pay off, you'll pay it off in two or less. My wife and I did this, and we did it after I left the big paying job. So people go, that's easy to pay off debt when you're making, you know, six figures or whatever. When we decided that we had screwed up and we needed to do something about this, I was making $45,000 a year. We had $38,000 in consumer debt, and we paid it off in 18 months. My wife's a nurse. So you can imagine that, right? You can imagine that she wasn't exactly rolling in the Benjamins either. She's an LVN, so like not even an RN, like, you know, a pediatric nurse at the time. She now works for me, but at the time, you know, she was making $15 an hour or something like that. And we were able to do that in 18 months. Why? We decided that we could have all the nights out we wanted, all the nice bottles of wine we wanted, all of that stuff, as soon as we were done with this first. And I remember the day we paid off the last bit of that debt, we owed $3,800 on a truck. And that was, you know, it was kind of our last bit of it. We got the thing in the mail, and I said, oh, $3,800, hell, we got that in a bank account. Just write a check and pay it off. She's like, I don't know if I want to spend all that money right now. I'm like, well, if the truck was zero and the bank offered to give us $3,800 of it credit against it, would you take the money? She goes, damn it, and just wrote the check, you know? And we got the title a couple days later. That will take all of that fear, all of that angst, and just set it up on the shelf. It'll still be there a little bit, but it won't be on your back. It'll be on the shelf in the back of the room. So that's number one. Get that done. Then the next thing, start becoming a saver. I hear people all the time, I have $5,000. What do I need to invest in? $100 bills, $20 bills, $50 bills. But I'm worried about inflation. You're not worried about inflation, right? You have $5,000. You're not worried about inflation. You're worried about more money. Save your money. Don't even worry about investing injectedly crap until you have at least $30,000 saved up in cash. And when you get there, this is the difference. When you say to yourself, okay, now I want to look for places to invest my money, you will be extremely conservative with that money. You will look at that money and you will say, my number one duty is to protect that money. Where we've been convinced in America, our number one duty with our money is to grow our money. No, you can't grow something once it's been devalued or wiped out. So we should come at the approach of investing with, how do I protect myself from losses? Way too deep a topic to get into today, kind of get into technical trading and stuff like that. But I promise you, if you save $30,000 in cash before you invest your money, you'll figure it out because it'll matter to you. Where if it just goes in that automatic drip from your employer and they give you your 1% match or whatever the hell it is now, and you're off in these five little things you can pick from and all of them suck in general, and you have no way to safeguard your money because they've removed the cash option from almost all the 401ks now, forcing us into government debt as our conservative option there. You just kind of look at it as like, well, that just happened. It's like Social Security. It's like a someday thing. And you don't really own it. So own that savings. And then I would say, once you get there, it's probably time to try to find a good financial advisor, unless you want to become financially astute yourself, which I would prefer, but I know a lot of people are not going to. But I'm going to be honest with you. It's going to be very difficult. It's going to be extremely difficult for a person with $100,000, $200,000 to invest to find a financial advisor that's any good. Because most of the really good financial advisors work with accredited investors that have net worths in excess of $1 million. But there's advisors like that that take people on kind of as almost like apprentice protege types and say, if I help this guy now when he's doing a little better, he'll stick with me. And you can sometimes find that. Or you just become a student at this yourself. You learn how to protect your profits. What people need to learn to do is if you own a security and it makes you 15% and you've set a goal to make 7% a year, you just made 2 years. take the profits now. And that gives you 2 years to figure out the next cherry-picked place to put that money. What does everybody do? Dollar cost average. Don't worry about it. Don't time the market. Don't be a trader. You know what you end up being? The guy that gets crushed like everybody else when the market falls. So you kind of take that conservative, protective approach to your investing, but begin to broaden your horizons at that point too. I think it makes a lot of sense to own property, but don't be stupid. Don't buy property that's overvalued. Don't buy trendy neighborhoods. Don't buy good schools. I love people, well, I moved here because the schools are better. My response is always better at what? Indoctrination, programming, statism, worship of the government. What exactly are those schools better at? If you can, self-educate your children. Put them into self-directed learning, homeschool, unschool, whatever you want to call it. If you can't, if you have to rely on the government schools, start that, folks. Never call them public schools. They're not public schools. Sears is a public shopping place, okay? Albertsons is a public supermarket. You can go there as a member of the public and buy stuff. It's open to the public. A school run by our government is a government school. That'll change your thinking right there. If you have to rely on government schools, commit as a parent to spending an hour educating your children every day. Don't give me the bullshit, you can't do it. You can spend an hour educating your children to counterbalance the nonsense they're being taught in schools. And you'll learn more by teaching than they'll learn by having you teach them. So you'll be teaching yourself at the same time. Take that kind of approach as well. And begin to start investing, if you can afford it, and buy a piece of property. Buy something a half acre or larger. Start producing your own food. Plant perennial plantings. Start to invest in your land. Stop looking at a home as an asset when most homes are actually liabilities. And start realizing, when I first purchase a home, if I do so with debt, I have in fact purchased a liability. And my goal now is to begin the conversion process of transmitting that liability into an asset. Assets generate profit. Not necessarily direct cash profits. But if we can start taking our home and start to remove our dependence on energy, by starting at efficiency first and alternative energy second, start producing some of our own food, improve the underlying value of the property. If we can do that, we can actually turn the home into a homestead. And that's a very, very powerful thing. And it's something you actually have to ask yourself, why don't we even hear that anymore? Why doesn't anybody talk that way anymore? Because it's not good for the consumer-driven economy. What people are taught to do now, and you know this, find a small home, buy it as a starter home, wait for the equity value to increase, sell it, capture the equity, move to another house a little bit bigger, do it again, do it 3 or 4 times, then you finally get your dream home in your 50s. By the way, a 30-year mortgage, you're going to be in your 80s before it's paid off, just saying. And then when you get there, take out a giant home equity loan and go on vacation and put a pool in. Where what we should be taught to do is buy very smart the very first time and make a lifelong investment in that property and do so in a way that clouds up the assessment that the government puts on the value of that property to mitigate your property taxes, and then pay that property off as quickly as you can. And once you have a debt-free life, a stable family, you've prepared for the basics of emergencies. You could go 30 to 60 days. If somebody took your keys away from you, locked you in your house, you might be uncomfortable. You might smell a little bad, but you'd be okay 60 days later. You get to that point. You know you're educating your children to true education based on the trivium of grammar, rhetoric, and logic. You own your home. All you have to be able to cover is the property taxes, which, yes, are theft, but it's a function of modern reality. All of a sudden, now you have all of this boldness. So what people do is they act bold when they're afraid, if that makes sense. So bold is, I'm risking my life savings every week with no idea what the hell's going on, because this is my 401k, and the shiny guy in the suit that came and told me to said it's okay and not to worry because I'm young, even though I'm 40, right? So you're acting bold when you're afraid because you don't understand everything. When you actually take this approach, what you become is very informed, very conservative, yet at the same time, you become very bold. You pick and choose your risks. And that allows you to do crazy things like start a podcast in your car, right? Or whatever it is that you do. And I think that would be the most important thing. Somewhere in all of this, find your passion and build a business based on it. There has never been a time in history where it's easier to build a business from the ground up, from nothing to something, than right now. Anybody that thinks the heyday of the entrepreneur is over has not paid attention. My business could not exist without the internet. Your podcast, that's becoming its own business, could not exist without the internet. I believe that I could build a website on anything and make a profit. Maybe not a giant one, but I believe I could make a profit with a website dedicated to nothing but funnels if I had to. And I'm not talking about sales funnels. I'm talking about plastic and aluminum funnels. I could make a profitable website. Now, it might make $20 a month, but let that sink in. That you could take something completely preposterous and for a couple bucks in hosting and a little bit of acquired knowledge, make a profit with it. I can't remember his name, but the guy that's the president of Alibaba, the drop shipping import company from China, said, if you live in America and you're not wealthy by your 30s today, it's your own fault. It might be a bit of an oversimplification, but I believe there's real truth to it. Because again, you're talking to a guy that when I got out of the Army back in 1993, my first job was packing boxes in a warehouse. It was 130 degrees for $5.10 an hour. I was 21 years old. And by the time I was 26 years old, I was making over $100,000 a year. Never saw the inside of a college classroom, and it was nothing but hard work. And I'm telling you, if what exists today existed then, if you could start a podcast back then, if you could build websites and generate money the way that you can today back then, if you could take something like homesteading and do all your homesteading stuff, put it on YouTube and actually generate an income off of it, existed in the 1990s, I would have never spent any time, you know, traveling all over the country, meeting people I didn't want. I would have done that from ground zero. That's the opportunity that exists today. It's not easy. It's not easy. It's hard, but it's simple. And the difference is easy is something that anybody can do, even by accident. Simple is something you can do if you really want to. And that's the truth. It is a simple thing, but it's not easy. Okay. Well, I think you have to balance that with the desires of the person. So I'm going to assume, for your example, that this young person actually wants to have some level of their living come from the land directly. Because all of our livings come from the land. All of our, every resource we have is a natural resource. Everything of value, if you trace it back, came from some sort of a natural resource, whether it's an ore or something grown from soil or wood or energy that's harvested from the earth. But this person wants what you're talking about. They want to be able to walk out their back door and graze their breakfast on the way to the chicken coop or the duck holding area. If that's the case, then I think that the first thing that people see is a huge impediment is access to property. You can do some pretty amazing things with a quarter acre or less. I actually think that like a quarter to a half of an acre for a lot of people is the sweet spot because it will make you focus on efficiency. I own a 3-acre property, and I'll be honest with you. I think at my level, I'd be pretty happy if it was 30, and I could deal with 300, though I'd probably develop 30 and leave 270 as hunting land. So you got to crack that nut first. So if they're 18, that can be a problem, or the problem can be the solution. So that's a permaculture principle. The problem is the solution. So if you were that young, you didn't have money, you didn't have somebody leaving you a farm, and you didn't want to go to work as a wage slave, and you wanted to learn the skill set at the same time that you were developing enough financial capability to be able to actually acquire land that you could own long term, I would say to look at something like Curtis Stone's doing with urban farming. This is a form of spin farming where what he's doing is he goes into neighborhoods that are located in the right location, and most people could afford to figure out some way to rent a flat or whatever you got to do to live close to that location. He goes to homeowners and he says, hey, how about this? I farm your backyard. I pay you a lease rate on it, and here's what it'll look like. And he has an incredible book on this, by the way. It's called The Urban Farmer, and basically he's farming without owning any land. And he did that for about 4 years, and by the time he was done with that, he ended up buying one of the houses that he had been farming. So all the work was done there already. So that put him straight into a business model, an income, and a skill development. Because if you don't, you'll develop the skill, because if you don't, you get really hungry and really cold and really tired, right? So that would be one way into it. If you had a job, and you were looking to kind of edge your way into this, then I would say you got to look at buying the right property. I'd really recommend you get over to jefflawton.com and take a look at some of his free videos and the property walkthrough and focusing on three things with property when you're developing a property. It doesn't matter if it's a little property or a big one. Water, access, and structure. So we want to do a good property assessment when we're buying a piece of property. If you take kind of the approach of spin farming or leasing land or whatever first, you're going to do that anyway by then because you're going to have the experience. If you're going to go straight in, you really need to think about that. And I would try, if I were 18, 19 years old want to do this, I would think about a lot of different ways to do it. And see, that's the thing. There's not a single answer to this. One of the things you might very well do is rent out your labor in the construction field if you can find and travel to do it. You know, they're building houses somewhere. Frame, drywall, whatever. Work for nothing. Work for crap. Gain the skill set. Build a small house or a tiny house on a piece of land. Own it debt-free. Start out that way. So you have to figure out, how do I get into the ability to steward land? Some people don't like the word own, and I don't have a problem with the word own, but I also would touch with the fact that I'm mortal, I'm going to die someday, and then like whatever I did to that land, I'm not going to control anymore. So I see it as like I have a stewardship over a piece of property until the day they put a stone over my head. So you get yourself into that piece of property, and then you start looking at how am I going to provide as much of what I need without reliance on others. So then you're looking at energy-efficient construction. My personal biggest limitation on my property today isn't really financial. I could put $50,000 into a solar array for my house, but it's stupid because the house is not efficient enough to make it worth doing. It really doesn't make it. It was built in 1979. Do you know what interest rates were on a mortgage in 1979? 18.9%. Thank you, Jimmy Carter. 18.9%. So, if you have a house built in 78, 79, 80, every shortcut was taken at a time when we were working with 1979 technology. Right? So, this is not an energy efficient home. And in putting that kind of money into a solar array here, does it make any sense? It's also a place with a rock slab a few inches under the ground. So I can't really put a surface contact home in, though that would make sense. So I have to work with what I have. But if I was 18, I mean, I would really be very tempted to look for land that I could buy for cash if I had to kill myself for a couple of years to make the money and do all the construction myself from ground up. And that way you're going to know everything that can go wrong on your property. You're not going to have to call somebody if something breaks because you built it in the first place. You know how to fix it. And I would go as energy efficient as possible and as much of your own energy creation as possible. I would look to grow as much of my own food as possible. I would do that very, very heavily weighted toward annuals in the first few years until I could shift that over to perennial production of fruit and nuts and things like that. I would definitely develop skill sets around animal husbandry. There's no ROI on calories that's better than an animal that eats something you can't eat and turns it into high-quality meat. So that's pastured pork, that's pastured poultry, that's pastured cattle. And if you start looking at this, how much does a family of two or three or four really need? Will this year, we're building a tractor, an 8x8 chicken tractor. We're going to build two of those. We're going to spend about $100 a piece on them. We'll kind of nurse through this new group of ducks and geese, and we just won't even worry about them for right now. But then we're going to run two groups of 40 chickens, so 80 chickens. We'll have birds that you'd go out, and if you bought these the birds of this quality, you'd be paying for them $20 to $25 a piece. We'll have like $6-7 in them in total cost. Okay, that's 80 birds. That's more than a chicken a week just from that little activity alone. That is an incredibly high-value product. And then since you've done this for yourself, and you have this attachment to the fact that that animal actually gave its life for you, it's not breaded crap in a red and white bucket, okay? It's an animal that you raised, so you're going to say to yourself, the only way I can honor this animal's life is to use every single bit of it. So like what we'll do, we actually have a processor because I don't have the time to process myself. I'll take these 80 birds down to the processor. I'll have 40 processed as whole birds and 40 parted out. The first thing I'll do is I'll come home and I'll throw 40 chicken backs, necks, hearts, livers into a pot and I'll make 7 gallons of chicken stock. I'm done with chicken stock for the year. I mean, I'm good. I'll can that and I'm good with chicken stock for the year. We'll take the rest of it. We'll cryovac it. We'll freeze it. We'll have meals for the, you know, probably we'll eat chicken 2 to 3 times a year off of that. When you start saying things like, okay, this bird we cooked whole, now we're going to go ahead and make soup out of that. That's 2 meals. Maybe a little bit that's pulled off is for enchiladas. That's 3 meals. So all of a sudden, just that one little thing that's not that hard to do. It takes 8 weeks to raise those birds, by the way. Same birds the commercial people raise, just raised in a humane way that actually makes them a lot more high quality, flavor and just nutrition. So then you say, okay, well, that's great. So you're getting a meat yield. But that's not what I'm doing. What I'm actually doing is taking those 80 birds on a dilapidated piece of land, and I'm moving them on a daily basis over an 8-week period, and I'm regenerating that piece of land. Next year, when we do that process again, our feed costs on the next 80 birds will go down. Because the birds from the first year that we had to feed heavily will have provided fertility and disturbance to improve the pasture for the next group of chickens. And then, depending on our goals, we can just create incredibly lush pasture with that, or we could advance a forest behind that that leads us into perennial production. If we space the trees right, we can move and pasture chickens right through more of a silvopasture manner with a forest around them, which in Texas is great because now they're shaded. So they're going to have a higher survivability rate. And if you start looking at that, then I can start doing my timings. So over time, we grow trees like persimmons that grow very large and have mast overhead that hold their mast and drop their fruit. If you don't pick it yourself, they don't drop that fruit until like January. So now I can run chickens in the winter when it's not hot. And I can overgraze them on a free yield, a high caloric yield. So, I mean, it's difficult for me to answer your question because all of that's just one element in this design. I would say that the individual is going to have to decide what's most important to them. If you want to make a living on a quarter of an acre, I can show you how to do it. It's called a backyard nursery. Start growing plants. Learn to graft. Learn to start trees and bushes from seed. Learn to clone. Learn to root. Learn how to do misting beds. That alone could be an income unit that can provide an income for a family. I know a family in New York that employs 7 people on a 4-acre farm. 7 people, full-time employees, paid quite well for what they do. You know what they grow? Roses, right? So, and people, when I brought that up at Permaculture Voices last year, people were like, well, that's not permaculture. I want to grow food. I'm like, well, they're growing organic roses. They're charging a premium for them because of that. Do you know how much pesticides, nicotinoids, all that stuff goes into the production of things like a rose? Because no one cares because you don't eat it. So here's people that are actually improving land, but they're just smart enough to grow a high-value product. So when it comes to an income source off of a property, you have to decide what it is that you want to focus on for income. And I would also say you're going to have to learn basic business acumen, and you're going to have to learn how to do mathematical projections. You're going to have to increase your financial IQ. You have to know what things like ARPU are, or average revenue per user in telecom, or to make a generic unit. So most people think of, like, if I have a business and I do 10,000 units and I make $10 a unit, I make $100,000 minus my expenses. Great. If I want to double that, well, I need to go and sell twice as many. No, you need to increase your average sale price. That can be done by making the product more premium and being able to charge more for it. That can be done by figuring out other adjunctive products that we can add on and stack on and bundle the way the telecom sector does with your phone and your cable and your all that stuff bundled together. And you have so you have to learn that. You have to learn the concepts that are, to me, I don't get how we have people coming out of college, and I've never been, and I understand this stuff, and they don't. COGS, cost of goods sold. What is it actually? People say, well, I make $20 a chicken doing pastured chickens. No, you don't. You know, not unless space aliens beam your chicken to you all processed and ready to go, and you still have a marketing expense. What does that bird eat? What does it eat? I don't know anybody that's gotten to a level yet where their birds are 100% pastured. They're feeding. So what's the cost of feed? What is the cost in energy to get food and water to them? What are you spending in labor hours maintaining those animals? If you've built things like tractors, okay, which a tractor for those that may, I realize now I'm on a financial show instead of my own. A tractor is basically a large movable pen that lets the chickens have access to the ground so we can control their movements. Well, what did that cost? Until that thing's paid back, it's an expense against every bird you sell. So to design your lifestyle, you have to learn to think like a business person. And I think if there's anything we are totally screwing our young people with today, it's that our universities and our government schools are so dedicated to brainwashing them to the gloriousness of socialism. And I'm as politically agnostic as it gets. I'm an anarchist, so it's not like I'm preaching Republican here for somebody that might think so. But our schools are dedicated to teaching our children that socialism is good to the extent that they have villainized words like profit. And that means that a child or a young adult cannot come out of either high school or university and have any understanding, any fundamental understanding whatsoever of economics. They can't comprehend economics because to comprehend economics, the first thing you have to say is, how do I ensure that the effort that is put here is actually worth doing? And we define that with profit. And if profit becomes a cuss word, how the hell is a person going to understand economics? And I hear all these young people around permaculture, and you know what they say to me, Josh? Well, I want to start a company. I want it to be a nonprofit. Okay. And this is, I have to give credit to Mark Shepard for this. But if you have a nonprofit without a profitable entity attached to it first, you are a professional beggar. That's all that you are. The nonprofit is a tax vehicle so that when you become really successful and have surplus income and you want to do good things, you go out and create a nonprofit. You never call it yours. You put an independent board of directors in place and you take your excess evil profits, you put them in the nonprofit, and you get to decide where that money goes instead of letting somebody in Washington decide where it goes for you. You'll never hear that in school, either, you know, university or high school, business courses, whatever. So that person can't design the life that way because they don't have the knowledge. If I ask you, how do you get a nail into a piece of a wood? You'd say a hammer, okay? But if you didn't know a hammer existed, I need some sort of heavy, you can use common sense, some sort of heavy blunt instrument to bang it in. And if I showed you a hammer, even if you'd never seen one before and you looked at a nail, you go, oh, that'll work. What we've done is we've so de-educated our children that when you show them a hammer and a nail, they can't make the connection anymore because someone told them the hammer was bad because it's mean. It's mean to the poor little nail. It commits a microaggression. Seriously, it commits a microaggression. The nail didn't want to be in that piece of oak. And by the way, some evil bastard cut down the oak tree and made it into a piece of wood. I mean, so when I get into permaculture with young people, I have to give them a little bit of that brain shock because, like, I don't want to cut a tree down. Well, what are you going to live in? Right? What you need to do is make sure for every tree you cut down, you've done enough to make sure three grow back. That's the way you handle resource management here. And you start figuring things out. Like, so another need that we would have, if I have a homestead I'm putting in, I need fuel wood. So let's learn efficiency. So let's design something like a rocket stove. So we're going to do a lot of our cooking on a rocket stove. We can take little handfuls of wood, and we can cook full meals on them. So now let's go out and plant a tree like black locust. So we plant black locust. We give it about 4 or 5 years. It gets up till it's about, 8, 9 feet high. And we go and we're evil. We get the chainsaw out, burn fossil fuels, and cut it right off at chest height. Cut all that up into a bunch of little pieces. You know what happens? It grows back. It grows back incredibly rapidly. We can start cutting that tree for that type of use in 5 to 6 year rotations and never actually kill a tree again. Provide all the fuel and heat for our house that we would ever need. In a northern climate where I'm using more of a conventional wood burning heat, I might be doing my rotations in 10 or 12 years. But I can use the same tree, just applied differently. So when you want me to say how a person should design their life, what you're asking me to do is come in and paint your picture for you. And what I really prefer to do is say, you have the canvas, you have the paint, you have the brushes, you have the knives. Let me show you how they work. And then you paint your picture the way that you want your life to be. And it has to be that way. I mean, my last tenet in my modern survival philosophy is my plan cannot and will not work for you. What you do matters, and you have to make these decisions for yourself. All that I do is provide you the knowledge to build life the way that you want it. Because what happens is if I say do these 20 things, whether it's preparedness or permaculture or lifestyle design, you'll follow it right up to the first one that you don't agree with, and then you'll fall out and you won't do anything else. But if I say, here's all the knowledge that you need, here's the way to think about this, and I guess that's the biggest thing, is to learn systems thinking. To start realizing that every single thing you do, whether it's on a property or in your life or in an educational program, is connected to every other single piece of it. And whenever you do something, make sure you're stacking its functionality to do multiple things, and make sure you're putting it in the right relative location. And then I guess the biggest thing that our young people work so hard for but yet are so frivolous with is social capital. I think the most valuable thing that you can build today is social capital. That's why they call it social networking, right? Tweeting and Pinteresting and Facebooking and all that stuff. And if you think about what the entire life of a teenager or a young adult is around, being popular, going to the right party, it's all about social capital. But it's worthless social capital. How many people that you wanted to like you in high school, whether they did or not, where it was important and you made an effort for it, Josh, do you even know today? Do you even know where they are? Right? So we go ahead. See, and we spend so much time, and people worry about what clothes do I buy and what shoes do I wear and all this other. At least you did in the 80s when I was in school, right? That was how you were popular. You looked right, you dressed right, you talked right. All this effort into social capital with no understanding at all what social capital really is. I had not really a friend. He was an old man that was a friend of my grandfather's. Lived up the road from us. His name was Buddy Shoemaker in Jonestown, Pennsylvania. Buddy made wine, homemade wine. Really good wine. I didn't understand the word social capital at the time, but looking back, I recognized it for what it was. This guy could call a favor in anywhere. This was Buddy's deal. You grow grapes, you grow raspberries, whatever. You pick it, you put it in buckets, you bring it to Buddy's house. He writes your name on the bucket. You go away. When your wine's ready, he calls you. He takes half of the stuff that he made wine and gives it to you. He keeps the other half. That was it. That was his whole deal. And if he needed something, he usually didn't pay cash. You want parsley wine, you want raspberry wine, you want some real sake, what do you want? And he would barter for this stuff. And if he needed a favor, throw a couple bottles of, Andrew Spirko, my grandfather Biff's Concord grape wine at you, or whatever it was. And he could get anything done. And he was of value to the community. And there were a whole bunch of people that lived there that kind of knew how to making wine's not that hard. I make wines and meads and beers now, and I love doing it. But there were a lot of people that went, that's his thing. It's fall. I have a harvest. I take it to Buddy. Now I can go deer hunting, put meat in the freezer for my family, and I know by mid-spring I'll have a few gallons of wine to last throughout the year. That's social capital, and it's social capital on steroids. If this guy had wanted to be the mayor of the little town that was a little bit bigger that was the actual thing that owned us, which was Minersville. Guess what people do there, right? This guy could have been the mayor like that, right? He didn't want anything to do with it. So we're not teaching people about, as Ethan Rowland calls them, the eight forms of capital, and the chief one being social capital, though a little bit more awareness of that is happening just because you see somebody that, because of their online presence, can sell a lot of product or whatever. Financial capital is the one that everybody thinks of, but there's other forms of capital. There's experiential capital. What do you know? And experiential capital links into social capital because what you don't know, who do you know that knows? And if you have a good network, the network's experience becomes your own. Cultural capital is what's the value of the pure culture of what you're involved with? If you build a really cool homestead, guess what? People will pay to come work for you. I know it sounds nuts, but people, I have a thing going this Saturday, and people are going to pay me $15 to come here and work for a day. And we'll sell out, right? We'll get a whole bunch of work done. And I'm not taking advantage of it because we feed them really good and stuff like that. But that's because we've built a culture around what we're doing at Nine Mile Farm and the Survival Podcast. Living capital. I talked about planting trees on your property. Living capital is when I have a tree, I've taken an appreciating asset and I've taken it off of the tax dole. I put a tree in that I pay $20 for. If you had a tree on your property, that was an apple tree that was 15 years old, huge, dropping hundreds and hundreds of pounds of apples every year, and somebody walked up to you and said, I'll give you $200 if I can cut that tree down and take it away. You tell them to piss off, right? That tree's it's gone 20, 30 fold over what you paid for it, but it's not taxed. That's a form of living capital. Back to this cultural capital for a second. Why do people want to work for Google? It's not just financial capital. There's good paying jobs that you can have. If you qualify to work for Google, somebody else would pay you well. It's the culture there. Intellectual capital is beyond experience. It's more total knowledge, or it could be traditional intellectual capital like a patent or something like that, or a trademarked brand. Spiritual capital, you can't really put a number on it, but there's a certain value in being at peace with who you are and what your place is in the world. And if you start blending all of these forms of capital together, this should be a required course in high school. If we're going to have schools that children are forced to go to, children should be taught about these forms of capital so that they can learn how to actually work with each other rather than constantly tearing each other apart. The reason people tear each other apart and fight for a pecking order in these social systems and behave more like primates than human beings is because they're so limited in their knowledge of the value that other people have. It could be summed up. It was something like, what was the saying? Be careful of the toes you step on today. They may be connected to the ass you have to kiss tomorrow. And that's, kids don't get this. Like, the guy you're picking on at school today that you're calling a nerd is probably going to be worth a fortune in the future. And if we actually started to see each other for the value that we have, a lot of these problems that we have would go away. So I don't know if that's really an answer to the question, but I mean, that's where it leads to for me. Definitely. And I think one of the big differences between barter and financial transactions, and I'm going to say this when I want to clarify this, you can have a transaction that involves capital in the form of cash or money that's barter, and you can have just a straight financial transaction. For example, if you are forced to buy insurance that you don't want, and if you don't do it, there'll be some sort of a penalty, it is a purely financial transaction. If you're buying something solely because you have to have it because it's a need, it's purely financial. And in a lot of financial transactions, it's a tendency that either the person that spent the money feels victimized, or they were lulled into the false belief that they won, right? Like, I showed them I got that car for next to nothing. No, you didn't. They made all the money on the financing. This is the psychology of money in America today. The first thing a person, if I say rich, and we play word association, I say a word, you say a response to it. Not you, probably not your listeners, but the majority of Americans, if I say rich, they say greedy or something like that. We've been so warped to believe that. When you move to a barter mentality, the only way a transaction ever happens is that both sides feel they won. That you wouldn't do it. And many times you see people bartering stuff that they would have actually been happy to give away. But the reciprocant says, I feel that since you're willing to give me something of value, I should be willing to give you something of value in exchange. And if you don't want it, pass it on to somebody that does. And one of the biggest pieces of my modern education going, you know, if I call my modern education since I started becoming a teacher, I had a friend named Ron Hood that was an icon in the survival industry. He actually owns the domain survival.com to tell you how long ago he got in the game. And he was like a brother I never knew the day that I met him. And we both had pretty big egos. I was getting started out, but I had a little bit of stardom ego going. And he had like that establishment ego. And he also had this kind of attitude that people in this industry, when they approached him, were looking to get something from him. And we met, and I could tell he was worried about that. It took about 2 seconds for both of us to drop shields and be brothers. And we had an incredible friendship for about 2 years until unfortunately he passed away. And I only ever actually got to see him in real life, face to face, and shake hands and break bread with him about 3 times. But we talked on the phone and by Skype almost weekly. And in one of the events that he ran that I went to, I learned about a thing called the barter blanket. And this is where you lay down a blanket, somebody steps forward, lays down an item for barter, and then anybody else that's watching can lay down an exchange item. You have to sell it a little bit. Why would you want it? That type of thing. And you'd have 10 people offer 10 different things against the one. And the guy that laid down the first one decides, I'll take this deal, or I don't want any of it, or how about I split it in half and I get this and this. You know, just basic barter. And when I started doing my training events here at my farm, I thought, you know what? A great way to honor his memory, but to tell his story, break out a bottle of his crappy gin, and he loved that sapphire blue crap. And I keep a bottle here, and if anybody ever comes to this house that knew Ron, you drink a shot of that whether you want it or not. And I pass that bottle of gin around, I tell Ron's story, and we start our barter. And you see people barter like, especially newbies that have never been before, barter like they're going to the store at first. It's, what can I get? What can I get? What can I get? And then you start to see generosity flow. And you start to see people do things like, oh, I have a vacation home, you know, on the beach in California. It usually rents out for $2,000 a day. That's an actual item that's been put on my barter blanket. And you see a whole bunch of people sit around and go, gee, I'm too rich for my blood. And the person go, what do you got? What do you got? I didn't set a price on it. What do you got? And you see somebody trade something that maybe has a value of $200 for $4,000 worth of time in a vacation home. Well, the person that owns that home knows the stipulation is you got to pick a day I don't have it rented. So is he going to sit there empty anyway? But they've thrown that out kind of as a generosity. I've done things where I'll say I'm going to give away 5 hours of my time consulting. And as you might imagine, I'm pretty stingy with my consulting time anymore. And I'll have 2 or 3 people throw down something, and I'll go, okay, everybody pick up your items. I don't want your items. I'm going to do it for all 3 of you. because you took a shot. And this is what happens when you move into barter, because you start to realize that there's more important things than what we initially get from something. Building relationships, knowing we can come back. And I actually think that you start gravitating more toward what Toby Hemingway describes as a gift-based economy. And I don't mean gift schemes, but in Permaculture City, he talks about the barter that never was. Like, we're told before there was money, everything was bartered. But in a village, let's say, where I was the knife maker, and your son needed a knife, well, I'm the knife maker. So you'd come to me, you get a knife. Well, that's what I do. I make knives. So when you need a knife, here. I don't have anything to give you right now. Okay, here. I got like 20 of them sitting here on the table. I make knives. That's what I do. I don't have anything else to do. Here. And when I needed something, it was just there. Now, people start to look at that as like socialism or communism, but those orders of human interaction were prior to the advent of the state. These were hunter-gatherer societies that had kind of formed a little bit of stability into a village. And they were always limited in headcount to about 100 to 200 people, and it would have to then break off. It would get too big. It would start to become a bureaucracy, even without a bureaucracy. And I'm not fanciful. I don't think we can go back to living like that. But I'm also, as a modernist, a believer that we take the very best of everything that we can assemble together. And we put that together kind of Bruce Lee-like, right? We absorb what is useful, we reject what is useless, and we add what is uniquely our own. And that we can be building these types of individual communities all over the country, both geographically based on real interactions and virtually based on online interactions. We can start to develop our own economies, our own forms of money, our own systems of value exchange. Bitcoin taught me something. Money's bullshit. Money's a fabrication out of thin air. It's an agreement between people to assign a value of energy to an inanimate object that's really worthless, right? It's a system of accounting. When you come to me and say, I want to buy your old iPhone, and I say, $200. You give me some paper with some numbers on it, I give you the iPhone, and the transaction ends. The only purpose the paper serves is an accounting. Because now I have the $200. You have your iPhone. You can go reprogram it, do whatever you want. But I need something of value that I can go prove to the next party in exchange that I have actually, that my value came from something. Right? And that's all Bitcoin is. Bitcoin just keeps an accounting of who exchanged what and puts a value on it. And it's our confidence in that value that actually allows it to propagate. And people look at the American dollar and go, it's all based on debt. It has to collapse. Why doesn't it? Because the confidence is there. Because people believe that it has value. Therefore, they're willing to exchange it. And if we can just continue to evolve away from that, and I'm not saying I want to get rid of money tomorrow morning, right? Because I earn a living mostly in Federal Reserve notes. I'll take Bitcoin, I'll take silver, but most of my income's in money. And most of my purchases are in money. But wherever I get the opportunity to exchange non-monetary barter, I'll do it. And I'll do it every single time. Well, so it's something I struggle with every day, but my basics are this. I have living creatures on my property. If I don't take care of them, they'll die. So when I get up in the morning, doesn't matter what else I got to do, I do that first. I make sure everybody's going to live through the day. Then I come in and I do my show. That takes precedence over everything else, over guest interviews, over consultation calls, over any of my peripheral businesses, anything like that. The show must go on in the old adage. So that gets done. When that's done, then I take a look at do I need to do any marketing for the show? Are there any commitments that I've made? Do I have any accounting to take care of? Stuff like that. That gets done. If I'm free at that point, I get out and work the land. Otherwise, it's, you know, maybe I have a conference call with a partner in a different business or something like that. But the way I've made this work is a couple things. Number one, I've started saying no to a whole lot of stuff. I have people coming at me all the time wanting to do something with me. I'm like, you go do something. You go do it. You don't need me. You think you do, and you think because I touch it, it's going to turn to gold. Trust me, I've had failures too. You go do your own thing. Stop telling me what you're going to do and go show me what you're doing, right? So I've started saying no to a lot of things. The other thing I've done is when I do get involved with partners in a business, like we have a business right now we're working on to develop a new type of caging so that suburbanites can raise quail for meat and eggs. I think that'd be a great thing to put that level, because you can't, like what I said about the chicken tractor, you're not doing that on Maple Street, right? So we want to do that with quail for people. Much easier to process, higher value nutrition, higher value product that you put out if you want to sell it. But this is what I told my partners in that business. I will see to making sure that people know about it. I will market it through my platform. I will test bed it right here because I have quail, and I'll make sure that we find all the things that are wrong with it because I'll just use it. You make me prototypes, I'll use it and tell you everything's screwed up, and we won't release it till it works right. Everything else is on your plate. You guys have to worry about accounting. You guys have to worry about tax reporting. You guys have to worry about inventory. If there's some financial investment, I'm willing to put some of that in the game. But overall, it's on you. You don't want that deal, can't work with you because I don't have any more time. And that seems very kind of hard-lined, hard-nosed. And I, all, you know, part of what got me in trouble in the past, and I overextended myself, was I always want to say yes. I always want to help people. But I also realize a lot of times when you think you're helping people, what you're doing is what I call trying to breathe for them. Right? You're trying to make somebody successful. A person that's going to be successful will be successful without my help. A person that's not going to be successful still will not be successful with my help. All I can do is inspire. And you talked about throwing out all these great ideas. I have people all the time say, I want to tell you about my idea, but we just signed a non-disclosure agreement. Get the out of here. I'm sorry. Go. Get out of here. The dog's looking at me like I'm yelling at him, right? Like, I, because I don't even have time to talk to you now. If you think I have time to steal your idea, which probably 20 people or other are already doing, you're out of your mind. I just let my ideas go. Because I know that I come up with some stuff that could really be good for people and could really be good for both the customer and the producer, and that I am absolutely not going to be able to get it all done. I'm not going to be able to control everything. I'm not even going to be able to be a part of everything that I can come up with. So I'll just throw it out there, and I figure if I throw something out to 150,000 people, one person might go, you know, that could work if... That's when I think you're going to be successful. When you take my idea, and the first thing you say is, yeah, it's not really whole yet. It needs this, this, and this. Because that's what I do. When I do decide to ferret out an idea, I come up with, like, oh, it's going to be great. And I map it all out and write up a proposal, even if there's nobody to give it to, just so I can look at it and make sure it makes sense. And I start working through it and go, oh, that's wrong. That's wrong. That needs an adjustment. Oh, gee, if you do that with a quail, they break their eggs. That's, you find that out when you get a broken egg. Okay, so you're always going to have, like, an idea is never complete when it's first birthed. It has to be massaged. And I feel if I can put out, you know, over the next 10 years, 1,000 ideas and 250 of them become businesses to support families, the ego that I don't want to give this stuff away because someday I'll get to it is inherently selfish, and it's also just inherently misguided. I mean, we get 24 hours a day, and I feel that I do a better job of making the most of those hours than most people do because it's hardwired into my genetics, I think. I said my dad was a coal miner, but he was a coal miner. He ran, you know, for years he ran his own tire shop. Today he's doing pallets. The guy, you know, doesn't really have to work anymore, but he's out busting his ass, rebuilding and selling pallets, manual labor. And he's, you know, in his late 60s. Why? Cause he doesn't know anything else. He doesn't know anything but work. And I come from a family that has, we're out of the Ukraine, and we're just hardworking people. And I love work when it's something that I actually see that I'm producing value in. So when I do my podcast, and I get an email from somebody that says, hey, because of you, we started this little soap business. Here's a couple of bars of soap. I'm like, that's cool. And then when I hear from them a year later and go, yeah, we did $45,000 in soap last year, and my wife's quitting her job now, then I'm like, hell yeah. And I'm thinking, I would never build a business on soap. So that's why I don't want people bringing me, like, their, like, do you think this is a good idea? Don't ask me. I've been wrong a lot, man. Remember Power Rangers? When that came out, I thought it was a billion-dollar blunder. If I was a TV executive, I would have been like, kids aren't going to watch this. I mean, I don't know everything. So my time management is I focus on first what needs to be done and then second what I want to do. And then I don't have time for anything else after that, you know? We have this little duck business. We produce these eggs, and, you know, that makes us about, I think our gross billing on that's about $1,100, $1,200 a month. After the expenses, it pretty much pays the base of our mortgage, not our, you know, interest in, well, it pays our principal and interest. What it doesn't pay is our tax and our PMI and all that crap. But we're not doing it for that. I could take the same time we put into these ducks and put together one marketing program for the podcast a month to sell something and make more money. But my ducks keep me sane. You know, I work with coworkers that sing all day and don't talk bad about each other now. They maintain my land. I bought a tractor. The only thing I've used it for 2 years is the little cart on the back to haul stuff around. I don't have to cut weeds. I don't have to cut grass. I don't have to provide fertility. So that time, while not financially the most profitable, I guess what I'm saying is I've built a lifestyle business. It's not just about the income. It's about the lifestyle. There's nothing that I want to do that I can't do. And the things that I have to do are things that I don't mind doing. And I think that's when people start looking at you and going, holy crap, how do you get so much done? Well, if you want to do it and you're able to just get rid of things that you don't want to do, it's amazing how productive you become. Yeah, I mean, the best website is, as you said, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and there's a shortcut to that. You can just go to tspc.co, tspc.co. Don't put an M on the end of it. It's an actual domain, just CO, and that'll link you there. When you get there, you can find pretty much everything else I'm doing. You can link over to PermaEthos, which is our permaculture initiative. We're doing some really great things with education there. We have a really exciting group now on Facebook called the Regenerative Agriculture Group. It's like permaculture, but I don't have to explain to somebody that's never heard the word what that means. And we have a group there of doers. It's all people that are working to get stuff done in their own backyard. Lots of entrepreneurial stuff on that, from raising broiler chickens to microgreens to you name it. I really recommend people check out the Regenerative Agriculture Group. And everything else we're doing, we have like sub communities. I have a forum that I don't even post too much, hardly anymore. That's run by my moderator team of about 25 guys and gals, really great people. We have a Zello channel. Zello is like ham radio without a ham radio. It's you turn your smartphone or your computer into like a push button radio, and there's like chat groups on it, and we have the most the largest group and most active group on the whole Zello network. The Zello board of directors have actually met with the people on my group to discuss making Zello a better platform because they're the most heavy user group on the whole network. Incredible people that look after each other, leverage technology to do. We've had women that had to travel across the country by themselves, and they'll put a little app on their phone, and the whole Zello group can see where they're at, travel along the way, keep in touch with them. Somebody's always on the network, making sure that if anything goes wrong, that somebody's there to help them. I mean, stuff like that. When I start thinking about that and going, well, all that was a thing that I set up and let other people take over. That's what this stuff's all about. So thesurvivalpodcast.com is a place to go. I do have a business podcast. I did like 130 episodes and then just went, until somebody does every single thing in that podcast with their business and needs something else, it's intellectual masturbation. So until that happens, until somebody brings me their business and goes, I've done everything you said to do, and I'm at a sticking point, that's on permanent hiatus. I ran out of time to do it. But if you want to build a business, especially online, jackspirico.com will tell you how to do it. I can always be reached through my email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. If you actually want me to see your email, put TSPC in the subject line, and that goes into a special folder that gets kind of priority for review. Hey, man, I'm happy to do it. Okay. I might be. It would depend. It would depend on where I thought it was going next. When I look at something like silver, which is an inelastic commodity, in other words, there's so much of what's built in America today and built around the world today, electronically alone, that requires silver, and nothing else will do it. And there's a finite amount of silver. That I believe if you got down in the $7 range with silver today, with adjusted inflation, et cetera, that you are at an absolute floor. I would probably be dancing in my underwear at $8. The stock market could get cut in half. And if that happens, first, it's a major bloodletting and it's a major recovery to go through, like we went through before. And then it would also be, well, how did it get there? Why is it there? Is it akin to 08, 09? Because I'll be honest, I did pretty good with that. I didn't go back in February of 09, which would have been the absolute bottom, but I went back in by the end of March. And if you look at a chart, that was a pretty good play. So it was a major opportunity to do very well. But why was because it was a single issue really that drug the market down at that point. My concern right now is if you see the market, correct by half, that it's a leading edge indicator that we could be entering a not just a recession, but a deflationary period. And if we do that, that market could go into a sideways skid or continue to devalue over time. Where money would be better served actually creating value. I just did a show on this today on, well, what if inflation stops? What if we see the end of inflation? What if we've reached a critical mass of energy in, because people are afraid of inflation, right? But if you think about how much money you'd actually have to produce and move through the economy now with the total weight of the monetary supply, hyperinflation is actually quite unlikely. We have a declining population in this country, even with immigration. How many more houses are you going to build when you have no more people than you already have? Right? How many more cars do you need to build? So if we end up with a stock market correction of 30%, 40%, 50% or more, that's due to an issue that's likely to correct over a couple of years, woohoo, major opportunity. If we go into a long-term trend that drags down the value of the corporations that make up the indexes, then we've got a totally different problem, and the time horizon line to recovery could be much longer. If that occurs, even commodities like silver and gold may take a hit, but their floor to me is much more stable, and their long-term value is much more stable because people use the word market incorrectly. So we look at the market as the Nasdaq or the Dow Jones or whatever. But what people don't realize is these recoveries of these indices are not necessarily all they're cracked up to be, because a lot of the companies that made them up when they were really high before ain't in them no more. Yahoo was a major index stock when it was trading for $200, $300. What's it trade for? I don't even know. Last time I looked, it was like $30. It ain't in there no more. So that market didn't recover. What happened is different stocks helped that market recover. So if you're a mutual fund slave that just buys and holds and waits, you could be in for misery in that situation. So it's not that I wouldn't be happy, it's that I might or might not be happy, if that makes sense. Well, and the other thing is, if I'm telling you right now that, so I have two different types of metal. I have physical metal that's been bought over such a long period of time, and it is such just of a wealth assurance policy, I don't really give a damn what the the cost is. But if I'm going to trade metal on a movement, I don't buy physical metal. I'll buy an ETF, and I can trade it like in light speed. It's gone. So if metal's heading for a downturn, it's actually generally easier to see than stocks, than securities. It's pretty obvious. You can look at a lot of other indicators. And because of that, I'm probably not holding it on the way down. Where what you have with the gold bugs is they're looking at the person with the stock that's being told, oh, it's okay, it went in half, it'll be a big year next year, and going, yeah, but you lost half your money. Because this is like the great lie of the financial advisor industry. Look, Johnny, when the stocks went down by this much, they went up by this much in the next 2 years. If you had gotten out, you would have lost out on all those gains. Well, here's some basic mathematics. If a stock goes down by 50%, that same stock or index fund will have to go up by 100% to break even. Okay, because if I have a $100 stock, drops by 50%, it's 50 bucks. If it goes back up by 50%, it's at 75. So a lot of the things that are used to sell people on the concept of buy and hold are in themselves not inaccurate, but also they're not fully truthful. Because you'll say, well, look, they went up 45% in 1 year. Well, yeah, it went down 33% the year before. Well, then you see you're ahead. No. I needed a 66% gain to offset the 33% loss. And I've had financial advisors look me dead in the face. Right? Because when you say it with like 100%, people get it because it's round numbers. But when you apply it to fractions, you know, more realistic numbers, they just, and then they start thinking, and holy crap. And what they're thinking is, well, I don't know. American Express told me to show you this diagram. I was trained to do this. And so if the market goes down and I'm not holding stocks, I don't care, and it is an opportunity. If the market goes down and I'm holding the stocks and the index funds or whatever, then it's a bloodbath and I'm losing. And I don't know if you know this, but what they've done now is they've made it, I think it's like another couple days it goes, the law goes into effect, you can no longer put in a good till canceled order to sell a stock, or a stop loss as it's commonly called. So what I've traditionally done, if I have a security that's done really well for me, and I've talked about taking your profits, but I think there's still some upswing in it, I'll throw a stop loss up like a buck or a point or two underneath it where I'm still going to harvest profits. And if it comes down, fine. And if it keeps going up, I just keep chasing it with that good till canceled order. You now have to renew that order every single day. That makes me concerned about what they see coming. Now, what they said that they did this to do is to prevent all these orders from being triggered and driving the market down. But it's not going to stop the high-frequency traders. But we can't go there. That'd get into a whole new thing. No problem, man. I'll get it spit out in an MP3. I'll have it to you in a few minutes. All right, man. Take care.